Hi, I'm Jody Carlton, neurodiverse relationship expert, and welcome to season 4 of my podcast, Your Neurodiverse Relationship. This season, I've asked Mona Kay of the Neurodiverse Love podcast to join me as co-host to talk about some pretty personal stuff. Mona and I both help partners and couples understand how neurodiversity is impacting their relationship, and also how to navigate difficult decisions and choices. We've identified 5 key steps for assessing your relationship challenges and determining a path forward for yourself and your relationship. For some of you, this means working with your partner to gain insight and tools for communication and connection, and also figuring out strategies that work for you as a couple, even though they may be pretty non-traditional. But hey, if it works, it works. For others, it will mean recognizing if and when it's time to end your relationship. Mona and I have both been in marriages with neurodiverse partners that lasted over 2 decades. And in this podcast series, we're going to share with you how we navigated our own relationships along the way. And let's just say we didn't know what we were doing. Mona and I are going to go deep into the good, the bad, and the ugly. In order to share these deep and vulnerable memories, we both chose to record this season without video to prevent the distraction of talking to our screens. We know you will recognize yourselves and so much of what we have to share, and our hope is that you will feel less alone and that our journeys will help you in your own neurodiverse relationship. Welcome. What will we talk about today? Welcome to another episode. And I have my co-host here today with me, Mona Kay of the Neurodiverse Love podcast. And if you haven't been following this series already, if you're just jumping in here today, I really encourage you to go back and listen to the previous episodes on this series that we've been doing on navigating your neurodiverse relationship. Today, we're going to talk more about identifying options for yourself, for your relationship, figuring out what those options are, and figuring out a path forward. Mona, thank you so much for doing this series with me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's really been great to share what we went through because we know, Jody, we're not alone. And what's so wonderful is that together we've been co-facilitating a support group that we're calling Navigating Your Neurodiverse Relationship. And they're for mixed neurotypes. So we have folks from all different neurotypes. We have folks that are autistic, autistic ADHD, ADHD, and identify also as neurotypical. And it's not for couples, but because we have 2 groups, if both partners in the couple relationship want to attend, they can attend at different times. It's only $25. Per session. And what's so wonderful is that sometimes hearing from another person who isn't your partner, but is a different neurotype than you, you get a feel for what your partner might be going through, what they might be thinking, what they might be experiencing that they may not have ever really been able to communicate to you. So we've had amazing conversations and amazing vulnerability on all sides, and I think some understanding. And I think what's great about this support group is it's called Navigating Your Neurodiverse Relationship. And it's really about kind of, should I stay or should I go? You know, what are the things that I need? What are the things we need to talk about? What are the things that I need to think about? And so it's a great place to learn more and to hopefully discern what your next steps are.
Yeah. And both of us are always just floored at how powerful these groups are and how much people are sharing with each other. And the chat is always blowing up on Zoom and where everybody's talking to each other about the topics as well. And it's just been, not only is there affirmation for those when from what people hear from others of the same neurotype, meaning you're either not autistic or you're autistic or maybe you're ADHD, but not autistic. And it's so affirming to hear some other people talking about their lives in a way that really sounds familiar and it's relatable. But then also to see, again, like she's saying, or to hear and see someone talking who's a different neurotype that may be more like their partner, and literally hearing them say and share some of the same things they may have heard from their partner. And like Mona's saying, it's hard, especially if you're in an antagonistic stance or if you're in what I call the boxing ring where you've just become, you're defending yourselves from each other all the time. It's hard to be open to hearing what your partner has to say. And we may think we are, but it can be so hard. And sometimes our own perspective, we're just really so rooted in our own perspective especially if we're feeling vulnerable and hurt and unloved or criticized and rejected. Just so many of those words come up a lot. And it's hard to hear what may be going on for our partner. But then when you hear other people saying the same words, sometimes it's helpful to go, okay, maybe what my partner's experiencing is valid too. So it's really powerful in that way. But then also to hear the different stages that people are in terms of making their own, navigating their own relationships. Some of these folks in the support group are still really wanting to make their marriage work or the relationship that they're in. And they're trying to figure out how to do that, trying to figure out if it's possible to do that. But they aren't in a place of, they haven't reached a level of contempt that's just really destructive. And Mona talks about contempt a lot, or some in one of the, or I think it was the last episode. And then others, though, are at a place where they're just, it's such a painful relationship and there's a lot of antagonism and contempt. And but they're still just wondering if there's a sliver of hope, or like she said, or should I just go? And some people are looking for affirmation that it's probably not going to work. And so the support group is not a coaching group. It's not a counseling group. We don't tell people to do what to do ever, but it's just a great place to have a conversation about what you're going through. So we'd love to have you. You can just go to jodycarlton.com, which is my website, and select the services tab. And there's another link for groups there, and you'll see the registration for it, and you'll see what dates and times are available. So that's how you get registered. And again, we'd love to have you. So Mona,
yes,
let's talk today about identifying options. How do we figure out what choices we do have? Because sometimes when we're in these relationships, it feels like we don't have any options. It feels, a lot of people I know say to me, I don't have any choices, or, you know, it just feels like I'm trapped or stuck. So what was it like for you when you were going through this process and figuring out what those options were?
Well, first it was hell. And I was very honest about that. It was really hell, mostly because I know that we both still loved each other. And I think the hell was in my own head in a lot of ways, because I was looking for options. The trials and tribulations were throughout, you know, probably the last 15 years of our marriage. But when our daughter went to college in 2014, that's when I really was looking at, okay, what are my options? So at that time, I was talking about separation. I did not want a divorce. I thought if we could separate, then the light bulbs would go off somehow. And we didn't know we were a neurodiverse couple at the time. So I thought separation could give us some time to go for therapy individually and as a couple. Well, we didn't separate until 2016. But the other thing that I realized that I was doing, and I'm sharing this because I think it's important for folks to think about this in their own relationships, I was getting emotional intimacy through friendship with other men. There was nothing physical. I never cheated on my ex-husband, and I never would have. That's just me. But I realized that my male friends were giving me something that I wasn't getting in my marriage. And that wasn't healthy. That wasn't the right way to move forward and be in a healthy marriage. So I also, before we separated, I also suggested to my ex that we open up our marriage and that we have a polyamorous relationship. And I thought that would give me the emotional reciprocity and the physical intimacy, which were both important. He did not want to do that. I'm not sure I really wanted to do it either, Jody, but I was looking at all options, right? And then the other thing, the house next door to our house was for sale. And this, again, was before we knew we were a neurodiverse couple. And I said, why don't we buy that house and you or I can live there? One of us can live in this house and one of us can live in that house. And then we can, you know, have dinner or meals together whenever we want to, and have sex and get together whenever we want to, almost as though we are dating. And he's like, absolutely not. Why would we do that? That would be, you know, double the bills. That's crazy. It's not like we were rich or anything. But I thought, you know, that might be a good option. And I realize now, Jody, that the option of living in separate places probably would have been a great option if we had had more money and could have afforded to do that. So those were some of the...
Why do you, why, before you keep going, why do you think that? I think it'd be helpful for people to hear what your thoughts are there.
Okay. So the reason I say that is because when we did separate, for the first time, my ex-husband lived on his own. And he had never lived on his own before. Well, he had lived with me, but never on his own. And what I realized, and what I think he realized, was that he liked having his freedom to do things when he wanted to, how he wanted to, in the timeframes he wanted to, because I was always rushing him. And, you know, he was always late or almost always late to everything. So that kind of calmed his nervous system. And I realized that we could have dated, or we could have been probably married and lived in separate locations, but planned times together. He was not very supportive of planning things. But I think if couples are both on the same page and are willing to plan at least some of their time together, I think living in separate locations could be really helpful, because each partner then can kind of regulate their nervous system on their own. They can have their own interests, their friends over if they want to, engage in their special interests, and not having the other person kind of looking at them with, you know, like a desire to be with them and them not wanting to do that. So I think it could work really well for some couples if you can afford it.
You know, I'll talk about my journey here in a sec, but I've actually seen that work for couples, particularly ones that never got married. If they are just perpetually in a long-term committed relationship and live separately. And I've even known people to live next door, like you said. And then others who are married, separated their bedrooms first and foremost. And I talked to so many people that's been a necessity. First of all, not necessarily a strategy, but a necessity, because somebody snores, or somebody needs the fan on, or somebody can't handle the light, the night light, or the tossing and turning. When you can't get your sleep, it just becomes, you know, we live in a perpetual state of anxiety. But above and beyond that, I've known couples to live on separate floors of the house, and they call it an in-home separation, where for some people, they do that for therapeutic reasons to try to salvage their marriage. But others have found that once they do that, it really is beneficial. And I've told that and they come to me sometimes thinking that the goal is still to move back together. And I'm like, why? Right. You know, if this is working, why do you want to do that? You know, and I mean, you can still have sleepovers, you know, if you want to one night. And but then you also have the option to, if she or he starts snoring, go back to your own room, you know?
Yeah, actually, Jody, my ex and I, again, before we knew we were a neurodiverse couple, we did start sleeping in separate bedrooms. I'm going to say it was about 4 or 5 years before we separated. And the reason was we were both snorers, mm-hmm. and we would disturb each other's sleep. Plus, we were on very different shifts. Like, I had to get up at 6:30, 7 o'clock to go to work, and my ex didn't go to work until, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and he would stay up till 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. So he was coming to bed, waking me up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and I still had to get up at 6:30. So I lost that last hour and a half or 2 hours of sleep, and I would get mad, you know, and it wasn't pleasant for him either. So that was a good thing that we did sleep in separate bedrooms, but we still had a very active sex life. And so I want to say that to the listeners, that doesn't have to change your sex life.
No, and I've known people to say, well, I just like, you know, having them there beside me. And it's like, okay, I understand that, but we got to do a cost analysis here. And, you know, what's it costing you to stay in the same bedroom? So as far as my story, it's quite different from yours. And my ex-husband and I both came from a pretty conservative background. And so our families and our own values when we got married were, you know, we did not live together before we got married. And we both just had brought into the relationship, into the marriage, some pretty traditional values about marriage and about sharing a bedroom. And I know that I can speak for me. I can't really speak for him, but I think he would agree with this, that it just never occurred to me that we could not, that not sharing bedrooms was an option. Mm-hmm. And it's bizarre when I think back that it didn't occur to me, because he had pretty extreme sleep apnea and ended up having to have a CPAP machine young, and he snored so bad. And I definitely lost a lot of sleep But it never occurred to me that, and I think it was some of those traditional values of, there was just not an option. And it wasn't because we had this, like, we honestly didn't have this great sex life. My marriage was different than yours in that regard. And we struggled from the very beginning sexually and were not aligned and in our drives and even in our beliefs about sexuality and our comfort levels with sexuality. So it wasn't really that for us, but it was just more this traditional mindset of you're married, you share a bed. And we also didn't have an extra bedroom. That's the other thing. The first, I don't know about, we didn't have children until we were 5 years in. So we would have been able to have, we would have been able to do that earlier in the marriage. But by the time things got pretty bad, we had children and we just didn't have an extra bedroom. And my ex was definitely the kind of guy that was, he was like, you're not kicking me out of my bedroom. I'm not sleeping on the couch. Mm-hmm. He would have never been the one to go. And I have had a musculoskeletal type issues for years from autoimmune stuff. And so my body would have hurt if I'd slept on the couch. Sure. I couldn't. So some of that was practicality, but you know, not long before I moved out, which I would say probably 6 to 8 months, my son got really sick. I don't remember what it was. It was just a childhood illness. And we had this huge king size bed, and he ended up sleeping with me because he had seizures when he was younger. And we were a little concerned he might have a seizure because of the fever. And so my ex ended up sleeping in his room and my son slept with me. And then we just never went back. Like it's just nobody said a word. He didn't say a word. I didn't say a word. He just stayed in my son's room, and my son was still pretty young. And he absolutely loved being able to snuggle with mama. And so we just never changed it. And I finally started getting sleep, and he probably did too. But I think it's just looking back, I think it's helpful to share my story because I know that there are a lot of listeners that are faith-based and have some pretty traditional values. And it's very hard for them to consider not sleeping in the same room. And you went on to bring up polyamory, and I've had many clients who have brought that up. I know for us, that never would have been an option, but you know, both of us emotionally stepped out, like you were talking about. I know that he had some emotional connections with women, with some women that he worked with that made me very uncomfortable. And there was at least, I can't remember, I mean, when I stop and think, there was one colleague that I had that I definitely connected with on an emotional level. No, I never had a physical affair. I don't think he did. I don't have any reason to believe that he did, but we both were definitely looking outside of it, outside of our marriage. And of course, that is a huge symptom of a problem. That's not,
yeah.
We villainize affairs in our culture, especially here in the US. And unless there's a toxic personality disorder that's there, that's a whole different ballgame. Affairs of any kind, emotional, psychological, physical, are a symptom of a problem.
Yes.
So that's, as far as sharing bedrooms, that's my experience. But then I want to also say there are other things that we tried to try to fix things, and it none of it was going to fix it, Mona. And I don't think we really knew and understood that we were desperately trying to fix our marriage. But we went to counseling. You know that we had various counselors through the years, but we tried to fix our environment and our situation. And like, we moved several times, and it was a lot of times related to a job for my ex. Or I remember the last move we made, well, backing up even before that, early in our marriage, we moved overseas to Ireland because he was one of his special interests, which I didn't realize it was a special interest at the time, was a particular type of history. And he wanted to go get a degree in an area at a school overseas that where he could really kind of be in it. And I, looking back now, I totally know it was a special interest, because once he got that degree, he didn't have any interest in pursuing a career in that. And I was kind of like, well, they even offered him a full ride PhD, a scholarship for a PhD. And he's like, no, I'm good. I'm like, what? Wait a minute. Hold on.
You moved for that?
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. I really didn't want to move overseas. He really did. And as a matter of fact, I was in my second year of my master's degree, for my counseling master's degree. and he got accepted, and he was going to go and do it alone overseas for a year while I finished my degree. And literally the day before he left, we said, you know what? If you do this, it will absolutely be the end of our marriage. Because if you go, and we already knew at that point, we were only married, I guess, maybe 2 years at that point. And I mean, looking back, there's a part of me that wonders if maybe that's what we should have done. Of course, I would not have my beautiful, wonderful children. And I don't, you know, that I wouldn't trade them for the world. But at that point, we already knew the distance, that kind of distance, like an overseas distance, would have been too much for us to survive. But then I did end up moving with him over there. And I had a great experience. To be honest, it was the best years of our marriage, because he was absolutely blissing out on his special interest and was so happy. And, you know, I was so codependent. You know, I talk about that on previous episodes, that him being happy was like my job, which it shouldn't be. So since he was so happy, I was happy. And so it was great years. But then when we came back, it's like in a way, he was a bit of a sensory seeker, like new, exciting. And I certainly was. You and I have talked about that part of me, that, you know, the next exciting thing is what I'm looking to do. So we moved a lot.
We did too, Jody.
And a couple of years before I finally moved out, our last move, we were in a subdivision that had an HOA, and it was HOA hell. It was just awful. I mean, the neighborhood was nice and the people were nice, but we just were so tired of having all these rules with HOA. So we tried to find a place that was more rural, and we both grew up in rural Georgia. So that was where our hearts were. And I think we truly believed that if we could change the setting and kind of get back to, we ended up moving up into the foothills of the North Georgia Mountains and on this beautiful property just on the side of a mountain ridge. And it truly was like serenity. It was just so peaceful and wonderful. But within the next 2 years, our marriage literally became so antagonistic that it was dangerous. I was afraid. I was literally afraid that he might hurt me or the kids. And that's genuinely not who he is. But the rage and we just reached this level of just exceptional toxicity that we had no idea how to fix. Yeah. And so a lot of what we were trying to do to fix it was just trying to change the setting, change the house, get another degree, get another job, and none of that worked.
Yeah, I totally understand, because, you know, I've shared that I'm ADHD, and for me, I have like a 7-page resume of all the jobs I've had since I was an adult. And, you know, because I think there were things missing in our marriage and in myself that I hadn't dealt with, I was always looking for the next, you know, squirrel to chase after, you know, the next bright thing. And my ex would have been very happy staying in one location, in one house or one apartment for the rest of his life. And so I think when you're looking at options, I think if you are going to be in a healthy relationship, then you have to understand what each partner needs to be healthy individually, and then what you need to be healthy as a couple. Because I don't think my ex and I were thinking that way. I think we were thinking about what we each needed individually, and we were very codependent, like you said. And so we were making decisions based on external things rather than looking deep inside ourselves individually. So there are a lot of options out there, Jody, and we've talked about quite a few, but I think anything that you can think of that would work for you. I have folks who come to my support groups who live in separate states, and they have a plan for when they will visit each other, and they alternate. Sometimes one partner goes just to the other partner's house because they are the autistic partner and prefer not to travel or prefer not to change their location. They may stay for weeks or months, but there's some kind of plan in place. So I think whatever you can think of, if you both are in agreement and neither one of you is doing it just to keep the marriage together, this is just Mona's thoughts, I think it can work and it can be healthy for both of you. But if you are doing it just to keep the marriage together, and I know there are a lot of faith-based folks that probably listen, and I'm not Catholic. I'm not Christian. I'm actually Jewish. So this is not an issue or wasn't an issue for me. You know, if you're giving up part of yourself, if you're giving up your emotional health, your physical health, your financial health, your spiritual health to stay in the relationship, I personally don't think that's healthy for either one of you. And that's just my thought.
No, I totally agree with that. And I know that a lot of people, when we talk about identifying options and figuring out a path forward, whatever the culture they're in, whether it's family culture, faith culture, just society, even the country that people live in, because I know we have listeners all over the world, all of that really does impact what you see as your options and your choices. And for some people, there are the options truly don't exist, like living in separate houses. It's just not an option that would in any way be accepted by their family, by their society, by their community. And there can be shunning and excommunication. And I've had clients who were excommunicated from their faith communities because they left marriage. And so all of those things are factors. And I know that for me, that was certainly a factor. We weren't actively involved in a church community at the time. We'd been raised Southern Baptist, but honestly, we had both really stepped so far away from a faith through over the years that wasn't really something that either one of us was considering. But the people in our world, our family members, and the other people in our just community at large would have really had issues. And it's not that we need to make our choices based on what other people want for us. Absolutely not. But it does impact us. If we choose to live separately, but our family, refuses to speak to us because we've done that, then we, when you're looking at those options that you have, it's important. You have to be able to look at what kind of, again, goes back to cost analysis, what are you going to lose otherwise? And it's hard sometimes to figure out what are my actual choices? What are my options? And I really encourage people, though, to think out of the box as much as possible. And if you want to look at what you truly cannot, this is off the table, can't do that, can't do this, can't do that. But you want to look within your own yourself, your own relationship, and ask, what options do I have? What can we do? And check in with yourself to see if there are, if you're putting any parameters on yourself that you can say, I've always believed this, but why do I even believe that? Or is it something that is this a belief I can challenge of my own if it will make our marriage work in some way that's fulfilling for both of us?
Yeah, I think that's really important. And nobody knows what you are going through in your relationship, no matter what your neurotype, right? Because even if we try to explain to others, because I remember the Christmas before I separated from my ex, I was sitting with his sisters, my sister-in-laws, who had known me for 30 years. I mean, they were in my life, my entire adult life. And I said to them, I don't know if your brother and I are going to make it. I'm thinking about separation, possibly divorce. And they were shocked. Mm-hmm. And they were shocked because they had no idea what was going on behind closed doors because we had never shared it. And I hear this from a lot of neurodiverse couples. And so the persona or the couple persona that we were playing out in front of everybody during holidays is very different than the persona, or not even the persona, the reality of who we were as a couple behind closed doors. Really, the only person who saw a portion of what we were experiencing together was our daughter. Mm-hmm. And I remember her saying to me when she was in high school, Mom, please do not divorce Daddy while I'm in high school. So I waited. Now we laugh about it. She's 27. She says, you shouldn't have listened to me, Mom. I'm like, well, you're my daughter. I would have given my arms and my legs for you. So I listened. Mm-hmm. But, there are going to be people in your life that you're going to try to explain what you're going through to, and they're not going to understand it. So that can add to your emotional distress, to your challenges in your mind, to you questioning whether you should move forward. And again, this is for all neurotypes because there are so many adults that are either recently diagnosed or recently identify as autistic ADHD or autistic ADHD. And then they try to tell the people that are close to them. And they're like, no, you're not, because you're not like this character. You're not like, you know, my friend's 12-year-old son or whatever. And so there's lots of things that prevent you from considering options because of what other people think. And I really do think, this is, again, just my thought, that one of the things that I said to myself really, really made the biggest difference. And that was, I said to myself, Mona, if nothing changes in the next 2 to 3 years, how are you going to feel? Because I could only change myself. And so for me, the path forward was, I need at least a separation. I need to see if, and we both dated during our separation, I need to see if there are other men who I have a better connection with. I need to see how I feel when I'm not with my husband at the time. I need to see how I feel as a person, as a woman, because we had been together, you know, we'd been married 28 years together, 30. And so figuring out that path forward, Jody, for me, was thinking about, if nothing changes, how will I feel and what will my future look like?
Mm-hmm. How about you? What helped you figure out the path forward?
So I had finally a really amazing therapist who was just for me. I had gone to see her. I think we had given up on seeing couples therapists. And so, but I was just really, I feel like I was drowning or struggling, just hanging on by a thread, honestly, emotionally and psychologically. I had no real connection to many friends at that point. And so I had gone to a therapist just for me. And something I want to talk us to talk about, and I'll start the conversation, is inappropriate hope. And I know up until that point, I had really been clinging to this hope that we would eventually get there, that we would eventually figure it out somehow, when through the years we had been in this cycle of increasing dissatisfaction, increased misery, basically. And then it would blow up, come to a head, and then we'd reboot. Because we really did love each other, and it would just get bad. And then we would reboot. We would feel awful. We'd be like, okay, you know, no, we're not going to do this anymore. And you know, we're just going to try harder. We had no idea how to make it better. But what had happened was, over the years, the blowups had gotten worse and worse and were coming more and more frequently. And to the point of, like I was saying before, it was just so, so dangerously toxic. So I went to this therapist for me. And I just remember her saying to me, she's like, Jody, when are you going to leave? And I said, what do you mean? And she's like, she just reflected back to me what I was saying and what she was hearing. And I'm like, well, at that point I had considered leaving. I think 10 years earlier, I'd even talked to an attorney and decided not to go. And so of course it had been something that had come up off and on for me, and he had, you know, we'd both brought it up, but I just kept holding on to this idea that it was going to eventually work itself out. And she was just like, look at this pattern, look at yourself. You're like dying, death by a thousand cuts here. When are you going to leave? And I was like, I couldn't process it. I was almost mad at her. I was almost angry with her for saying that, but she planted a seed, and I kept working with her. And I started realizing that the hope that I had wasn't what you and I've talked about as inappropriate hope, because all signs pointed to the very real reality that we were literally going to destroy each other. I mean, it was so bad that I was afraid of him. And again, I don't think that he is a dangerous human being.
Right.
But we were so locked into this horrible intensity of conflict that it had become scary. Like, there was rage on both sides, and I was afraid of him. Maybe he was afraid of me too. I don't know. But, you know, he's a much bigger person than I am. And I was just afraid of his rage. I was afraid of his anger. But she said that to me, and it started to slowly sink in that I had to, number one, save my life and save my children. And again, I want to emphasize, I'm not ever, if go back and listen to the episodes before today, because I am not blaming my ex-husband for the downfall of our marriage. And I talk extensively about that in the previous episodes. But irregardless, it doesn't matter who is to blame, because nobody was, neither one of us. the reality was we were bleeding out. It was bad. And my children, actually, I'd gotten them into, they were, well, my son was experiencing just extreme anxiety. And my daughter, who's autistic, her stress was obvious. And I had gotten them to a counselor who tested them both for just, they were looking for anxiety, depression. And she told me, she said, Jody, both of your kids are testing out to have levels of like trauma levels that are meet criteria for PTSD. And I was like, what? I think that was the moment of truth for me. Mm-hmm. When I found out my kids were being so traumatized by, you know, our home life.
Yeah.
That was it. That was my line in the sand. And I just knew I had to get them out of there, me out of there, get him out of there, you know, get my ex-husband, get us all out of there. And it was a very high conflict situation in the beginning when I did leave, but it eventually really, you know, it settled down over the course of a few months. It was just very, very tense.
Sure.
And eventually we got to a point where we could communicate better. It felt safer. All of it, you know, my kids were able to go be, you know, I want to say this because I've had a lot of partners say, I'm afraid to leave because I'm afraid for my children when they're with my ex, because for various reasons, you know, sometimes he explodes and yells at them, it's especially autistic partners, when they get overwhelmed and sensory wise and relational wise, they sometimes they'll explode. And I mean, I was doing my own share of exploding, to be honest, but so they're worried about their kids being there without them to run interference. But I want to say, and I want you guys, those of you who are listening, to hear this, taking myself out of the equation for when my kids went to see their dad, he was so much more regulated. Mm-hmm. Our relationship was so dysregulating for both of us. Well, and you know what? I have to own up to it too. I was more regulated.
Sure.
We both were more regulated because we weren't in each other's presence. We weren't triggering each other. We weren't setting each other off. And so my kids really didn't experience from either one of us. When they were in my home, when they were in his home, it became a safe places. Whereas when we were together, it was not a safe place. And now, you know, you fast forward, well, it was 2016. Now we took a trip together down to visit a college with my son a few weeks ago. The three of us, we spent 14 hours together, and it was a perfectly enjoyable day for all three of us. And we can communicate now. We can get along. We're regulated now because we're not in that marriage anymore. He's remarried and he has been for a while, but we get along now. But we had to stop the bleed. We had to stop the bleed.
Yeah. I think what you say is probably going to hit home for a lot of folks, because I hear those sentiments a lot in the support groups that I facilitate for the non-autistic neurotypical partners. And I'll share what I have seen in my family dynamic between my ex-husband and my daughter that might be helpful for others who were trying to figure out a path forward. I didn't know this when we were all together as a family, but I discovered it with my daughter. I was asking my daughter to be the interpreter and the translator for my ex-husband when he was still my husband. Mm-hmm. She understood both of our neurotypes without us understanding our neurotypes, or she understood how our brains worked, and she could communicate with either one of us. And basically, I put her in a role she should never have been put into. Mm-hmm. And didn't know what else to do, because there were times I just was not able to get through to my ex. And so I could say to her, could you go tell your father? Could you go tell your daddy? Could you go ask your daddy? Could you go find out if your daddy wants to? She would go in there and he would respond to her with calm, and he would respond to her where he would sometimes ignore me. And so I've told her I will pay for therapy, any therapy she wants. She has gone to therapists several times and she's talked through and worked through some stuff. I think she's in a really good place now. But I know it affected her, and I realized how much it affected her. She and her girlfriend came to stay with me for a few months during COVID, and we met up with my ex and his girlfriend at the time. I don't know if they're still together, but at the time, I was in a great place. You know, I had been dating, and I had no interest in having anything but a friendship with my ex. But my daughter still had that trauma. She still had that anxiety from having to manage communication between me and my ex. Mm-hmm. But it was a totally different relationship. I didn't need her to be the go-between, but mm-hmm. she still felt that was her role. And I realized, because we had gotten together quite a few times, all of us together, her and her girlfriend, him and his girlfriend, and me. And I was so comfortable. You know, we were laughing, we were having fun, we went out to dinner, ba-da-da-da. And when she was leaving, the day she was leaving to go back to her home with her girlfriend, we got into a little bit of a tiff. And she started crying and shared with me what had been going on in her mind, that she felt she had to be the balance, you know, be the translator, be the one who balanced the relationships and the communication. And I said to her, I said, that's not your role. It may have been when we all lived in the same house, and I apologize for having depended on you for that, but that's not your role. We're all grown adults and we can all talk to each other. And if we can't, then we don't have to be in each other's lives. And I think it took probably years for her to realize that that wasn't her role anymore. And she, I think, gets it now. But imagine if I had known, Jody, what I did, would she have healed? So, yeah.
I think that is so honest and so vulnerable of you to be able to say that and share that, because I know so many people are going to resonate with what you've said as well. And I think it's so very important that we not shame ourselves, because there's no user's manual for any relationship, first of all, for parenting, second of all. I mean, there's actually a lot of books out there, but nobody can really know your life, your children, your marriage. And no matter how much you read, how many books you read, or you know, friends you talk to, or even therapists you go to, nobody really knows what you're living. And I know I made so many mistakes that contributed to my marriage problems, you know, my parenting mistakes. I look back and I'm like, oh my gosh, that was not the way to go.
Me
but,
too.
You know, in the moment.
Right. You do your
sometimes
best.
You do what best. You do what you think's best. Sometimes you don't do what you think's best. You're just operating off of survival or sheer desperation. And I think it's just so, you know, honest that you acknowledge that. I look back and I also see so many things that I did that have affected my children. And my daughter, and actually we were talking about just this morning about how she still to this day really feels triggered when she sees or witnesses a woman and a man arguing. That's mm-hmm. that's kind of a romantic relationship of any kind, even if it's just a little spat. She said it's like a visceral reflex that she just, and it's a you know, it startles her. And she can see other people. She said it's not so much if she sees like two girls fighting amongst themselves or siblings or something like that, but if it's a man and a woman in a romantic relationship, she just has this immediate trigger. And you know, I know, and she knows logically that there's nothing, you know, she can able to kind of self check in with herself in that moment and knows what's going on. But she just witnessed so much conflict that was intense and scary for them and fearful for them. And sure. I know, I mean, if I was afraid, I know my children were afraid. They shared with me that they were afraid at the time. They were afraid of the intensity of it. And not afraid of their dad specifically, but just afraid because it was so, the screaming and the yelling was just so intense. And, you know, I want to circle back a little bit, Mona, to the whole episode where we talked about stopping the bleed. I know for us, that was definitely one of the bleeds was when we did end up having conflict. It had been going on for so long. In the beginning, I don't remember it being nearly as, and I'm sure it wasn't. We'd argue, but the intensity of it was not so, like it was, there was not rage in the beginning. Mm-hmm. By, you know, 19 years in to the marriage, and it was 21 years together at that point, it had moved, it had just been we'd been cycling through it so much, and add the layers of, you know, two children. I was just telling you before we started this taping, at one point we had three cats, two dogs, and three fish too. And both kids being neurodivergent, one autistic, one ADHD, one had epilepsy. I had an autoimmune illness going on. My ex-husband had some health issues of his own. It was just, there were so many layers of
bleeding.
Yeah. there was so much stuff that was unmanageable and out of control that we literally were like, I think we were like caged, you know, wounded animals, just baring our fangs, trying to fight. And we saw each other as the enemy.
Yeah.
So when we look at identifying options, I think that one of the things we talked about stopping the bleed so you can even look at what your options are. And sometimes that separation of space, whether it's a therapeutic separation or, living on different floors, or even just going and staying at your mother's house for a month or 2 weeks or whatever, or friends or something.
So it's important to get to that place where you're stopping the bleed. You're not in that antagonistic space. Get some space from each other, however you need to do that, so that you can then actually look at the options you have. Okay, so I think that's a good stopping point for this episode, step 4 of the 5-step series in navigating your neurodiverse relationship. Today has been about identifying your options after you're able to stop that bleed and figure out even what options you may have, thinking out of the box. And so the last episode in this series is step 5, and that's figuring out a path forward. Mona and I are going to share, again, more of our own personal journeys and what that was like for us when we were able to finally get some insight about our own marriages. So be sure to tune into that episode and also go back and listen to the previous episodes if you missed those.
Thank you again to Mona Kay for co-hosting this very important podcast series about navigating the choices and decisions that are difficult to make in our neurodiverse relationships. For more information about the courses, programs, coaching, and groups that Mona and I both offer, you can visit my website at jodycarlton.com and Mona's website at neurodiverselove.com. Be sure to subscribe or follow to get updates about new episodes.